Okay, I want to start with a problem, a really big fundamental problem in biology.
I love a good problem. What do we got?
It's about speed. We know the climate is changing fast. Ocean acidification, temperature spikes, I mean, it's happening on a decadal scale, sometimes even faster.
Right.
But evolution, traditional Darwinian evolution, is slow.
Glacially slow.
Right. You wait for a random genetic mutation, you hope it's useful, you wait for that organism to reproduce, and you hope that trait spreads. It takes
So
generations.
many generations.
So if the ocean turns acidic today, and you're an oyster sitting on a rock, you don't have generations. You barely have a lifespan.
You're dead before you can adapt.
Exactly. So the math just doesn't add up. How are these organisms surviving right now? Because we see them doing it. They aren't all just dying, they're acclimatizing.
And that is the central mystery we are looking at today. And the answer might not be in their genes, at least not in the way we usually think about them.
Okay.
It's in how they use those genes. We're talking about epigenetic intelligence.
Which sounds incredibly sci-fi.
It does, but it's very real. And we've got a fascinating set of sources today centered around a 2026 perspective paper and modeling study. It's titled Epigenetic Intelligence: How Organisms Track Their Environment Through Molecular Memory.
Led by Holly Mahler and Holly Putnam and their team.
That's the one.
And the mission for this deep dive is pretty specific. We aren't just talking about biology in the abstract. We're going to look at a mathematical model, a computer simulation that these researchers built to prove that brainless creatures like oysters and corals can actually learn and remember what the environment is doing.
And more importantly, we're going to see if the real-world biology, the mud and the water, actually backs up the math.
So let's get into it. The core of this paper is a stochastic simulation model. Now, whenever I see the word stochastic, my eyes tend to glaze over a little bit.
It just means random or probabilistic. Don't let it scare you.
Okay, but describe this model to me. Because when I read the paper, it almost felt like they were describing a video game.
It's very much like a game. To get it, you have to sort of strip away the shell and the flesh, just visualize the organism, our oyster and its environment, as two parallel strings of binary code.
Just zeros and ones.
Just zeros and ones. So floating in the ocean is a string of numbers. That's the environment. Maybe one means high acidity and zero means normal.
Okay, so the environment strain might look like 10110.
Right. And then sitting right next to it is the organism's genome. Well, it's epigenome, and it's also a string of zeros and ones.
And the goal of the game is to match.
The goal is to survive. And in this model, survival depends on matching the pattern. If the environment has a one at a certain spot, the organism needs a one there too. If there's a mismatch,
Say the ocean is a one, but the oyster is a zero.
that creates stress.
And we're not talking about emotional stress here.
No, this is physiological stress, cellular dysfunction. The model assumes that the more mismatches you have, the more stress the organism feels.
And here's the kicker, right? That stress is the driver.
It is the engine. When stress gets high, the organism starts trying to change its zeros to ones. It starts trying to remodel itself.
It starts rewriting its own code.
Exactly. But we have to be super clear here. It's not changing the DNA sequence. It's not mutating. That would be genetic evolution. This is epigenetic.
Right, so let's just clarify that term for everyone. We hear epigenetics a lot, but what is physically happening to that string of DNA?
Think of DNA as the hardware. Epigenetics is the software. In this model, the zeros and ones represent markers, chemical tags.
Like DNA methylation.
That's the most common one. It's like a little post-it note that gets stuck onto a gene that says, "Do not read this," or "Read this a lot." A one in the model might mean a gene has that methyl group, and a zero means it doesn't.
Okay, so back to our oyster. It's stressed because its pattern doesn't match the environment's pattern. It needs to add or remove these sticky notes.
Right, to match the pattern. And the researchers modeled this decision-making process using a weighted coin flip.
A weighted coin flip. Explain that.
Well, the organism can't think. It doesn't look at the environment and say, "Ah, I see the pH is low. Let me go adjust gene number 45.
It's blind.
It's totally blind. So it uses a probabilistic mechanism. It looks at a spot on the genome and flips a coin. Should I change this marker?
And the weight comes from the stress.
Yes. If stress is low, the coin rarely lands on change. The genome stays stable. But if stress is high, if the oyster is, dying, that coin becomes heavily weighted to change.
It starts frantically flipping markers.
Adding and removing tags, just trying to find a configuration that lowers the stress.
It's panic remodeling.
That's a great way to put it.
So does it work? If I'm an oyster and I just start flipping switches randomly because I'm stressed, do I eventually solve the puzzle?
And that brings us to the first major finding of the paper. They ran the simulation, the panic mode strategy, if you will, where the changes were purely random, driven only by stress.
Yeah.
It failed miserably. Think about it. If you're just guessing the password to your Wi-Fi by mashing the keyboard, you might get one letter right.
But you'll probably delete three correct letters in the process.
You're taking one step forward and two steps back. You're breaking the things that are already working.
Right.
So the model showed that with random guessing, the mismatch just hovered around 50%. It's a coin toss. You're not tracking the environment. You're just drifting.
So random epimutation, just like random mutation, isn't enough. We need a better strategy.
We need rule number one of epigenetic intelligence. You need a cheat sheet.
The paper calls this epsilon.
Yes, the parameter epsilon. This represents information. The model predicts that for an organism to survive a changing environment, it can't just flip coins randomly. It needs to know which coins to flip.
It needs a directional hint.
It needs to be able to preferentially remove the markers that are causing the problem. Instead of saying, I'm stressed, change everything, the cell needs a way to know I'm stressed, and I think that specific marker over there is the issue.
And when they plug that into the simulation, giving the oyster a high information score, what happened?
The difference was staggering. With high information, an epsilon of 0.8, the stress levels dropped from that 50% mismatch down to about 15%.
Wow.
That is a massive competitive advantage. That's the difference between surviving a heat wave and, well, bleaching.
But this is where I have to pause the simulation. Because it's easy for a programmer to type epsilon equals 0.8 into a line of code. But biology is wet and messy. Do oyster cells actually have a cheat sheet? How does a cell know which gene is causing the stress?
That's the million-dollar question. The model predicts they must have it or they wouldn't survive. Biologically, we think this comes from cofactors and specific enzymes.
Break it down.
Okay, take the European sea bass. The paper mentions this example. When the water temperature shifts, it doesn't just randomly methylate its whole genome.
That would be chaos.
It would be. Instead, the temperature change triggers a specific set of enzymes that go straight to the promoter region of a gene called CYP19A. The temperature signal acts like a guide.
So it recruits the methylation machinery to that specific address on the genome.
Exactly. It's not random. The environment provides the information that directs the enzymes. Without that guidance, without that physical link between the signal and the gene tracking is impossible.
So rule number one is don't guess, use information. Okay, now the paper moves on to a second rule, which I found really interesting because it sounds like an inventory management problem.
Rule number two, the balancing act, or what the researchers call coupling.
Right. So in the simulation, they looked at the relationship between adding markers and removing them.
Mm-hmm. You have enzymes that rate these tags, let's call them writers, and enzymes that erase them, erasers. The model asked, what happens if these two teams aren't talking to each other?
Like, what if the writers get really enthusiastic and start tagging everything, but the erasers are on a coffee break?
Exactly that. You end up with a genome that is hypermethylated. Every single zero has been turned into a one. The library is full. You can't store any new information because every page is already written on.
And the opposite.
If the erasers are too active, you strip the genome bare, all zeros. Both scenarios are catastrophic because you lose the complexity needed to match the environment.
So the model predicts that these rates, addition, and removal have to be coupled. They have to be linked.
If you ramp up the writers, you must ramp up the erasers. You have to keep the system dynamic. Biologically, this means regulating the enzymes, the DNMTs, which add methyl, and the TETs, which remove them, in sync with each other.
It's homeostasis. It's like you can't just inhale forever. You have to inhale and exhale to keep the air moving.
That's a perfect analogy. If you decouple them, the system crashes.
It really highlights how precarious this whole system is. You need specific information, and D, you need perfectly balanced enzyme pools. If either of those fails, the oyster dies.
It is precarious, but it's also robust when it works. There is one thing, though, that can break the system entirely.
Which brings us to rule number three. The researchers tested the limits of this intelligence. They asked, does this epigenetic tracking system work for any kind of environment?
And the answer was a definitive no. There are speed limits. This is the Goldilocks zone rule.
They ran a few scenarios in the simulation. Let's talk about slow and steady versus chaos.
Right. In the slow and steady scenario, the environment changes infrequently, maybe a seasonal shift or a slow drift over decades. The model showed that organisms are brilliant at this. They have time to sense the stress, flip the coins, use the information, and adapt.
They reach that 15% mismatch level we talked about. They're basically acing the test.
They thrive. But then they ran the chaos scenario. High frequency change. The environment flickers back and forth rapidly. Hot, cold, faster than the organism can physically keep up.
This feels like the relevant scenario for the 21st century.
Unfortunately, yes. And in this scenario, the organism enters a death spiral. It tries to remodel its genome to match the hot signal.
But by the time it finishes writing those tags, the water is cold again. It's lagging.
It's worse than lagging. It's actively hurting itself. Because the remodeling process itself uses energy and creates transient mismatches, the model shows that in a chaotic environment, the organism suffers more stress by trying to track than if it just sat there and did nothing.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
So there is a point where trying to be smart actually makes you stupid.
Precisely. Epigenetic intelligence is only intelligent if the world makes sense. If the world is random noise, memory is a liability. You're just chasing ghosts.
So we have our three rules from the math. One, don't guess. Two, balance your inputs and outputs. And three, know your speed limit. But math is math. I want to step out of the computer simulation now.
Let's get our feet wet.
We've been very theoretical. Does this actually happen in the wild? The paper claims there is empirical evidence backing up these rules.
There is, and it comes from some really charismatic and not so charismatic creatures.
Let's start with the sea butterfly, the pteropod.
Limacina helicina antarctica. Tiny, beautiful swimming snails. And they are the canary in the coal mine for ocean acidification because their shells dissolve so easily.
So what happens to their epigenetics when you drop them in acid?
Researchers did exactly that. They exposed them to low pH, and initially the pteropods panicked. Their methylation levels just dropped off a cliff. It looked like a total system collapse.
Which matches the model's prediction of a stress spike when the environment changes.
Right.
That initial mismatch.
It matches the transient mismatch perfectly. But here's the cool part. After about 6 days, even though they were still in the acid, their methylation levels recovered. They equilibrated.
They solved the puzzle.
They found a new stable pattern. 6 days. That gives us a real-world time frame for how fast this epigenetic intelligence works. It's not instant. It's not a reflex. But it's so much faster than evolution.
6 days is impressive. It's fast enough to survive a season, but maybe not a daily fluctuation.
Exactly. It fits right into that Goldilocks zone.
But what about memory? Because if you solve the puzzle, you need to remember the solution. You don't want to have to solve it again every morning.
For that, we look at the geoduck.
The geoduck, a clam that is famous for, well, looking very distinctive.
We'll leave the visual description to the listener's imagination, but they are fascinating animals. In one study, researchers exposed juvenile geoducks to ocean acidification. They saw specific methylation changes, genes turning on and off to deal with the stress.
Okay, standard response.
But then they put the clams back in normal water, and they checked them again months later. Yeah. The changes were still there. The clams remembered the acid exposure. The epigenetic tags hadn't just snapped back. They had written that experience into their physical library and kept it on the shelf.
That proves the molecular memory concept. It's not just a reflex. It's a record.
Exactly. And that memory likely primes them to handle the stress better the next time it happens.
But I want to push on that. Is memory always good? If the environment is chaotic, like we discussed in rule number 3, and you remember something that happened months ago, isn't that dangerous?
It absolutely is. This is where the model and reality intersect perfectly. If the geoduck remembers a high acid event, but the ocean has swung back to normal or gone in a totally different direction, that memory becomes maladaptive.
You're preparing for a war that ended months ago.
It's a double-edged sword, always.
And we also see this impacting the physical body, right? It's not just invisible tags on DNA.
No, it changes the architecture of the animal. Look at corals. Stylophora pistillata. There was a 2-year study, which is a really long time for an experiment like this, where they exposed corals to acidic water.
2 years is a huge portion of a coral's life.
It is. And the study found that epigenetic changes in a signaling pathway called MAPK actually altered the porosity of the coral's skeleton.
Wait, the skeleton itself physically changed?
Yes. The DNA instructions changed, which changed the proteins, which then changed how the calcium carbonate was laid down. The coral built a different kind of house because its epigenetic memory told it to.
That is mind-blowing. It really bridges that gap between the microscopic code and the macroscopic rock.
And sometimes it's a matter of life and death. We can't forget the oysters and the virus.
The Pacific Oyster Mortality Syndrome. Sounds like a horror movie title.
It is for the oysters. It wipes out huge populations. But researchers found something strange. They could predict which oysters would survive and which would die, not just by looking at their genetics.
But by their epigenetics.
By looking at their methylation patterns before the virus even hit.
So their epigenetic state, their configuration, determined if they were resistant.
Yes. It suggests that some oysters had learned a configuration, maybe from a previous minor stress or even from their parents, that made them resilient. It's a very Lamarckian idea in a Darwinian world.
So let's zoom out. We have the math. We have the three rules. Use information, balance your enzymes, and don't chase chaos. And we have the biology that shows oysters, clams, and corals are actually doing this.
It paints a picture of life that is so much more dynamic and computationally active than we usually give it credit for. These aren't just passive rocks. They are processing data.
But this brings us back to the start. The reason we are even looking at this is climate change. We're worried about the speed of change.
And that's where the paper leaves us with a bit of a cliffhanger. We know rule number three, epigenetic tracking fails when the environment is too chaotic.
And chaotic is basically the weather forecast for the next century. Extreme events, rapid fluctuations.
Exactly. So the authors pose a really provocative question. As the world enters this new era of volatility, will organisms stop trying to remember?
What do you mean by that?
It's a concept called bet hedging. If trying to track the environment is too costly, if you keep guessing wrong because the signal is too jittery, maybe the best evolutionary strategy is to abandon the memory system entirely.
Just give up on being smart.
Or become hyperplastic in a different way. Don't write things down in pen. Just use a whiteboard that gets erased every single hour. Or maybe they evolve to be even more sensitive, trying to catch tinier and tinier signals.
It's a high-stakes gamble. Do you invest in a complex memory system, or do you just roll the dice?
And watching how marine life answers that question over the next few decades is going to be one of the most important stories in biology. Because if they hit that chaos limit where the tracking breaks...
You could see sudden collapses.
...in species that seem totally fine right now.
There's also this massive knowledge gap here that we touched on briefly. We know that they sense the environment, but we don't really know how.
Right. We talked about epsilon or information, but what is the physical sensor? Is it a protein on the shell? Is it a change in pH inside the cell? And what is the granularity?
Granularity. What do you mean by that in this context?
Can an oyster sense the difference between a Tuesday and a Wednesday? Or does it just sense summer versus winter? If the granularity is coarse, if they only sense big seasons, then rapid climate change is going to be invisible to them until it's way too late.
They won't even know they need to flip the coin.
Exactly. That is the next frontier for this research, mapping the sensors.
Well, that is heavy, but also incredibly illuminating. It completely changes how I look at an oyster shell.
It's not just a shell. It's a hard drive.
A hard drive trying to survive in a magnet factory.
Perfect analogy.
We'll leave you with that thought. Next time you're at the beach, remember, there is a lot of computation happening under the water. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
See you next time.